You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 1st of September 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian Tobias and Andrew Muller.
There's a new look to The Review this week with plenty to look forward to as we preview and indeed review highlights from the week in film, books, music and theatre from around the world.
Coming up on today's programme, Japanese cinema with Mark Schilling, senior film critic for the Japan Times.
We'll also ask which books and which writers are on the radar of literary agent Claire Conville.
And we'll be chatting with Colombian musician and DJ for our weekly music review.
And as if all that wasn't enough, Matt Wolfe, the charming and eloquent London theatre critic for the International Herald Tribune, will join us live in the studio to talk through the upcoming productions in London and New York, which have attracted his attention.
So lots to look forward to on this week's Our New Look review here on Monocle 24.
So yes, welcome to Studio One and welcome to the New Look review. And part of our new look, of course, is that we don't do the magazines anymore because we've done that.
Well, it's so strange. The table is bare. We're used to having these piles of magazines, but we've lost our magazines. Partly a good thing. The magazine review is so popular, it has its own show.
Which premiered before this one, immediately before us, The Stack, hosted this morning by Tyler Brulé.
And it's actually great. It does fill the whole hour because they're talking to practitioners who work in the industry, and there's so many layers that they can talk about more than just reviewing magazines. So,
well, we did always used to sort of bitch about this slightly after coming off air on the review, that there just wasn't enough time to do the magazines thing because one of our guests would come in with four or five magazines and then get so carried away about talking about the first one.
Exactly.
That by the time you got to the end of the segment, they'd be just going, oh, yeah, and I bought these as well. It was like, oh, sorry, no time. But yes, The Stack, and if anybody listening missed that one, it is, of course, available from iTunes, from our mobile phone app, or indeed from our website at monocle.com/24.
But something lost and something gained, it does mean that our show, The Review, can really be a real review show. So, you know, we really get to delve into dance and theatre and film and TV.
We do, at considerable length, in fact, in a few cases. But it's very, very packed tonight because we do actually have literally all of those things. We have film, we have books, we have theatre and other stuff besides.
So stay tuned. This is The Review on Monocle 24.
And every week from here on, at the top of The Review, we'll be talking to a different critic from around the world to get their reaction to whatever exhibition, concert premiere or screening or, you know, weird live artwork installation involving balloon animals is the talk of their town.
And today we're off to Tokyo to hear what's been causing a ripple of applause in the world of Japanese film. And joining us on the line to talk through some of the titles that are being shown this week at the Venice Film Festival and next week, I think, at the Toronto Film Festival is Mark Schilling. And Mark is senior film critic for the Japan Times and also Japan correspondent for Variety. Welcome, Mark.
Yes, hello.
So it's interesting. I mean, you cover Japanese cinema, but Japanese cinema has very high visibility at the film festival starting off the autumn season. I wonder if you can talk about the one that really kind of you've been most interested at that's been showing at Venice as we speak.
Well, at the Venice Film Festival right now, well, actually it screened a while ago, a new film, although it's not a film, by Kiyoshi Kurosawa called Penance. Okay, and this was originally a five-part TV drama that was screened on Japanese television at the beginning of the year and has been condensed to 3+ hours for you know, the special screening at the Venice Film Festival.
How did it work as a standalone cinema experience? Was it one of those television programs that prompted that kind of addictive viewing? I speak as somebody who once watched season 5 of The Wire in two sittings.
The Wire, yes. In Japan, that sort of program doesn't really exist. I mean, we have you know, the major networks and that sort of thing, but for a major director like Kurosawa to make a TV program is kind of unusual. And this was screened on the you know, the Japanese equivalent of HBO. But it's just a five-part show. Okay, it was screened for about 1 month from January to February of this year.
And what kind of films has...
Not quite the same as The Wire.
What kind of films has Kurosawa really been known for, and is it unusual for him to be working in television?
Well, he's known for J-horror. I mean, people who know Japanese film or Asian film know him mainly for that. You know, he made films back in the, starting back in the 1960s, the most famous being Cure. And then another one, an apocalyptic end-of-the-world film called Pulse that came out about 2000. So, that sort of thing is what he's known for. And he has been changing. His last film was Tokyo Sonata, which screened at Cannes in 2008. And that was a family drama. It had no horror in it whatsoever.
Mark, I also wanted to ask about Shion Sono's new project, Land of Hope, which is also going to screen at Toronto. This is a reaction to the earthquake and tsunami of March last year. What has been his take on it?
Well, yes, this is a film by another director who is known mainly in the West for his extreme films, Shion Sono, who made Suicide Club and took Noriko's Dinner Table back in the early part of the last decade. So people know him for that, and he's done a 180 degree turn with this film because, as you said, it's based on the events of March 11th of last year, and it's quite unusual even for him. I mean, it's based on his own research. He went up to the north where all this happened and spent weeks talking to people and getting the real story. He told me, some of the people who talked to him later went on television, with NHK, the big public broadcaster, and were saying something quite different, trying to put a different spin on things than what they told him. So,
But this film isn't a documentary. It is a fiction, a piece of fiction. How does it work cinematically?
It's not a documentary at all. It's more like a story out of Kafka. These two families are separated when after a very similar disaster to what happened in, 2011, there's an excavation or an evacuation zone set up that runs right across their boundaries. In other words, one family has to be evacuated, the other is allowed to stay. So, how did this all kinds of things happen? Many not so good. And, they have no choice in the matter. It's... one day they're living a fairly normal life, and the next day everything starts to collapse.
How ready are Japanese audiences for fictionalized accounts of what was obviously a massive trauma for the entire country?
There haven't been that many in the theaters. There have been, of course, many, many documentaries, that sort of thing. But Sono was telling me, he's one of the few who is making, a feature film all about that one incident, because there have been some other directors who changed their films. In other words, they were shooting around that time, or writing a script around that time, and then they decided to rewrite. And that was one film of Sono's. He had a film called Himizu that he was making when the disaster struck, and he said, "Okay, I've got to rethink this," and he changed the entire film to reflect what happened.
Mark Schilling, senior film critic for the Japan Times and also Japan correspondent for Variety, thank you very much for joining us. We'll be taking a leaf through a few books next, so stay tuned.
Section D is Monocle 24's show about design. We explore the people and products, the buildings and businesses, the signs and cities that make life better. Each week we bring to life the relationship we have with the things that we live with.
Actually, one of my favourite objects is my motorcycle. I love going by motorcycle. I have this Royal Enfield, a classic English motorcycle from the 50s, but it's exactly as it was in the 50s, and I love the shape, the sound of the engine. I love really how it fits in my life.
We sit down with a cast of characters and chew through the issues at stake in the design world today, across manufacturing, craft, fashion, architecture, and graphics.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Wherever you're going this summer, and whether it's for work or play, let Monocle's editors be your travel companions. We've just refreshed and revised our team's guides to the world's top business cities and resorts, so you can have our 25-25 travel guide series in the palm of your hand with the Monocle app, available from iTunes, or download free guides from monocle.com. From São Paulo to New York, Capri to St. Bart's, we can show you where to long lunch or go for your morning run. Just head to the iTunes App Store and download the Monocle app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to the New Look review. Is it right to say a radio show is New Look?
The new sound, Andrew.
The new sound. You're listening to the New Sound review, which sounds just grammatically hideous, but never mind, here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, and Gillian DeBias.
And over the past 10 months, we've travelled the world's bookshops to hear from small business owners about what's been flying off their shelves. So now on the New Sound review, we're going to be getting a more in-depth view of the world of books from publishers, authors, booksellers, and agents to get their views on new books and, importantly, new writers.
And I'm delighted to say we're joined live in the studio this week by literary agent Claire Conville. Claire was an editor at Random House before co-founding her own company, Conville & Walsh, in 2000. Conville & Walsh now represent dozens of authors, including the satirist Charlie Brooker, the historian Misha Glenny, humorist Marcus Berkman, and the songwriter Luke Haynes. Claire herself managed to discover a Booker Prize winner, DBC Pierre, on the Victoria line. Welcome, Claire.
Hi.
That's probably a story that needs a little bit of elucidation. How did you find a Booker Prize winner on the tube?
It was a hot summer's day and I was leaving work to go home, and there was a pile of manuscripts by my desk, which is known as the slush pile, which are books that people send in without any introduction. And one of them caught my eye because it had a picture of a pair of trainers nailed to a cross. And for some reason, I thought of my sons, who were then sort of 11 and 13, I think. And so I thought, oh, that looks interesting. So I grabbed it from the pile, walked to the tube, got on the tube and started reading it. And about when I read the first chapter, I thought, nothing could be as good as this. Yeah. It's a fabulous first chapter and the rest won't live up to the first chapter. By, you know, Stockwell, I thought, this is really, really, really good. And by Brixton, I thought, this is a masterpiece. That's how I discovered DBC to Pierre on the Victoria line.
So what are some of the sort of new, fresh authors that are exciting you at the moment? I think you've brought one in.
Well, it's interesting. I think the sort of publishing world is divided between a slightly sort of cynical view that all the great books have been written, and that the 19th century was the sort of epitome of, or the epoch of the great novel, and that actually now in late 20th century, 21st century, a lot of people are writing, but nobody's really any good. I think I take the view that it's a very exciting time. Lots of burgeoning writers, nationally, internationally, people going to creative writing classes, people putting pen to paper, finding all sorts of different ways to publish and not just in book form. And I think there are some fascinating writers emerging. And I think this year's Booker long list is interesting because there's some old favourites such as Hilary Mantel and Will Self, but there are some first-time writers there too. And, you know, having a very smart, grand publishing house, say, like Jonathan Cape, is no longer a guarantee that you're going to get onto a long list or a short list. There are a lot of small independent publishing houses putting out very interesting novels who are being noticed by, you know, the judges of important prizes.
And so what's the first book you've brought in today that you wanted to talk about?
The first book I want to talk about is Umbrella by Will Self. I know Will, I've known him for years, he's a friend, and he's been writing both fiction, stories and non-fiction and journalism for a very long time. But this is the book that has hit the long list, a book long list, and I think a lot of people are calling it his masterpiece. And it's always interesting if you know somebody, because you have to, you feel them and hear them in the book, but you also have to step away from that and judge it for what it is. But I was blown away by this novel. Totally modernist, very challenging, uncompromising, about a psychiatrist sort of looking back over his life, but linking in with a young feminist called Audrey Death, who falls victim to, and I have to pronounce it carefully, encephalitis lethargica in 1918. And he meets her on a ward, in sort of NHS ward in the 1970s. But it's a narrative. There's no real structure. It's a narrative filled with different voices, some in his head, some outside his head. It's very funny, very profound, very brilliant, and a sort of sweeping tale, really, of the 20th century.
If you can talk about the structure a little bit, I was reading in advance of this show that it has no chapter endings or beginnings.
Yes, I mean, I think it's a true modernist novel in that it you know, chronological order, and it has no bearing or no meaning. It's just a it's like an ocean of different voices, and gradually people become individuated, and you learn about them, and they take shape. But it's not characterization in a formal sense, and it's not a story with a beginning and end in a formal sense.
How when you accept or submitted a new work by an obviously very established, very well-known author like Will, how difficult or different, I guess, is it from dealing with a new author? Do you have to sort of apply the same rules of policing the editing and structure, or with someone like Will Self at this point, do you just let him go?
I don't agent Will. He's a friend
right.
of mine, so I don't have that opportunity.
But as a general rule, with a really established author, is how different is that?
I think every agent is different. I do a lot of work with my first-time authors, the people I take on, the people who may be working on a first book. And one of the books I was going to mention was a book called Otter Country, which is a very different proposition from Umbrella, but it's about one woman's passion for and search for otters and travelling around the UK trying to find them. And she and I did a lot of work together on that. She was clearly a hugely talented writer with passionately committed to her subject, but she did need support to find her voice. And now she's found it. She's written a brilliant book. I think as somebody gets more established, particularly really good writers, I will comment if asked. And I will edit if asked, but only if I'm asked. I always tell the truth as well. I mean, I'm very tough on my authors, which they know. You know, I will always say what I think about their books.
I wanted to touch more on the Otter book. What makes the writing so exceptional for such a story that seems quite almost train spotting in the Otter world?
The thing about, anyone who lives, most people who I've talked to about the book, as soon as you mention the word otter, they just go, I love otters, and they make a little otter face, which is sort of just above the water.
Well, it's hard to imagine the person who would dislike otters.
Yeah. Well, it's Ring of Bright Water, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Well, there you go, and then everyone goes, oh, it's Ring of Bright Water, it's Tarka the Otter. So you're tapping in immediately into the English countryside, a sense of the pastoral, a literary tradition, a very strong literary tradition, which actually at the moment is finding a new life. So Miriam, I would say, will hopefully sit alongside writers like Robert McFarlane or Mark Crocker or I think she's called Kate Few, who writes about wild swimming. As people, it's called the neo-paganism. It's a kind of it's a new kind of sense of connection with pastoral life, rural life, wildlife in an increasingly fragile world, I suppose.
Are these writers that maybe in centuries before may have been writing poetry or just writing poetry? And...
I think there's a great tradition in England of observing nature and writing diaries. And yes, I suppose, somebody like Wordsworth in his own way was observing nature. But I think there has been a great tradition of sort of English botanists and naturalists, both in the UK and going further afield. So it's part of that tradition. It's a tributary of that tradition, if you like.
I was interested, well, part of me is now composing in my head the Anti-Otter Manifesto, because I think it could be a great controversial work. I'm going to go home and work on a pitch for that this afternoon. But I was interested in what you said there about helping a new writer find their voice. Is that an entirely instinctive process, or are there things you've learnt by now about how you help a fledgling author do that?
Well, I mean, this is an interesting book, which I'm very proud to represent. It's a writer called Rachel Joyce, and her book, this is her first novel, but it's actually been longlisted alongside Umbrella for the Booker Prize this year. And I heard her read at the Faber Academy, which is a creative writing course a couple of years ago. And I wasn't struck by the beauty of the writing, but I knew there was an extraordinary idea at the heart of the book, which is because it's about a man who walks across England to save a friend. He walks 600 miles from the West Country up to Berwick-upon-Tweed to hopefully save a friend who's dying of cancer. So it's a true pilgrimage, actually. But it was interesting going through the process with Rachel that she rewrote. When I first met her, I said, how many words have you written? And she lied and said, I've written 20, 25. And in fact, she'd written 7 or something. She's very funny about it now. When the book came in, I was so fascinated by the huge leap she'd made from, you know, those first few chapters that I'd read and hearing her read. She made an extraordinary leap. And then she did, I didn't work with her on this book. Her publishers worked with her on this book. But then she did very quietly another 3 months' work once it had been bought to get it to a stage where we could send it out internationally. But she's highly professional and incredibly connected to her subject and to her art, and very easy, every aspect of what she does, she'll discuss with you and, you know, talk it through with you and things like that.
This book started, I think, as a radio show, and
I wonder what
are the kind of themes that make it so special?
It's so interesting to see Umbrella and The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry on the same list, because they're so absolutely quintessentially different books. And yet they're both about one man's journey, actually. But I think the thing about Harold is that he's every man. He's a very ordinary person living in very apparently ordinary circumstances, who through a very difficult process finally finds himself in his mid-60s, essentially. And it's a book about love, and it's a book also about the changing nature of England, the things that have stayed the same, the things that are different. But what's interested me is that so many people have read it, from men, women, children, dogs, old people, you know, connect with it at a profound level, even though their experience of life may be very different from his.
I was interested in what you were saying earlier, and again in relation to Rachel Joyce's book about being tough on your authors, which is something that as a writer I vastly prefer myself. I would much rather have the editor who just says, here's what I don't like, here's what you need to fix, and here's what you need to do, than the one who sort of faffs and waffles. But does that always... Do the authors always take that on board?
No.
does this ever sort of... does it?
I think, you know, I never try and impose a view or, you know, on what I think is right. I try and support the author in what they're trying to achieve and make suggestions about how they might achieve it. There are much better editors out there than me, I'm sure. But in a very difficult publishing world, if I send a book out, it needs to be as pretty perfect as I can get it. Some authors love it, you know, long for feedback, I have a wonderful, magnificent author I represent called Sarah Hall, is absolutely connected and interested in what other people have to say about her work. Other writers find it very difficult. And I have been sacked, I think, once or twice on the basis that I'm over-involved or they don't like what I'm saying. And then more often not reinstated, but it has happened.
You talk and you've referenced the Man Booker list. How important, I mean, there's so many different awards these days. How important are they?
Very important. I think it's very hard. I think it's very hard for first-time writers, but actually very well-established writers now, to sustain an audience for all sorts of very complex reasons, partly to do with recession, partly to do with the way publishers market, partly to do with the sort of changing face of the sort of digital revolution. So a prize can really transform the life of a book. And it's nice, isn't it, for an author? I sort of think you sit in your room maybe for 2 or 3 years, you write your book. It's a very solitary existence. You want your peers to like it, and you want, whatever anybody says, you know, having that kind of affirmation is great.
It must be nice. Not that I'm bitter, obviously. Claire Conville of Conville & Walsh, thank you so much for joining us here on The Review. You're listening to Monocle 24. It's time now for a quick roundup of the openings and events you might want to explore this weekend wherever you are in the world. Your host, Monocle writer Nelly Gacheva.
This weekend sees the thin white duke, David Bowie, get his own film retrospective at London's ICA. The renowned Arts Centre is taking a nostalgic trip through Bowie's silver screen appearances, from commercial fun like Labyrinth to less-known gritty features such as Christian F. We recommend catching Tony Scott's The Hunger on Saturday. In San Francisco, the Field Conditions exhibit opens this weekend at the Museum of Modern Art. Around 30 design works are on display, drawing on the perception of space and the way we interact with it. It is curated by Joseph Becker and features art by local and international artists and architects, such as Daniel Lipskind and Libes Wood, to name a few. It is on until 6th of January. Back in London, James Nappet's exciting new venture, Bubble Dogs, opened earlier this week on Charlotte Street. The restaurant offers the unorthodox combo of hot dogs and champagne. We didn't think it could work. How wrong we were. Established this year, Copenhagen Ceramics is an exhibition space in Frederiksberg. Artists Louise Hingsgavel and Gitte Jungersen are reviving traditions of ceramics by drawing inspiration from the animal and human form. Having exhibited work in museum collections throughout Scandinavia and Western Europe, Copenhagen ceramics should be something of a homecoming for them. And if you want to enjoy some clever dance music, Matthew Deer's new album Beams is out now on the Ghostly International label. It would make a great soundtrack to your weekend. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gacheva.
Welcome back to the new look, or as we discussed earlier, new sound review. One thing that has not changed on the programme is that we will continue to talk about and indeed listen to music and hear new titles and meet new artists. And today we're doing that with Isabella Gonzalez Toro, known to her many fans and indeed friends as Isa GT.
Isa is a Colombian-born artist making, and DJ in fact, making music with Colombian-inspired electro beats and DJing alongside artists such as Radio Clit, Hannah Holland, Peter Pitzel, long list here, Cormac and Fake Blood, and she's part of a collective, Girl Core, a group of girls who host parties in cities all over the world. Welcome, Isa.
Hiya.
First of all, tell us a bit about your music. How would you describe it to someone?
Well, as you mentioned before, I'm Colombian born. I've lived in London for the past 10 years, and that influences my music in such ways as I bring Latin rhythms and mix it with electronic music and, all the London sounds sometimes. And, try to keep mixing those things together that are part of my life, my daily life here.
And it's often quite a kind of male-dominated world, the sort of DJing world. Tell us a little bit about Girlcore.
Girlcore is a collective of about 8 or 10 girls. It just varies. But we started in 2007 putting parties in East London. And we are from different media-related disciplines. I make music. There's people that are into PR. There's booking agents. All sorts of media-related jobs. And we wanted to get together and put on a party. And the premise of our party was supporting the female talent. So all our lineups were female, strictly, apart from one night a year where it was called Dragcore, and we invited all our friends that wanted to come, but they wanted to come and play, but they will have to do it in drag. And so we had a lot of, really, really well-known people, male artists coming to drag and play for Girlcore.
Was there a particular reason why you decided to assemble that all-female lineup? Was there a particular manifesto animating it, or was that just the bunch of people who happened to fall together at that point?
Yeah, it came up... it was casual. I mean, a friend of ours was doing the bookings at this place, Catch 22, in Shoreditch in London. And she wanted to have... Well, she wanted nights, basically. And by that time, we were hanging out with all of us together, all these friends. And the name Girlcore came up with playing with words in a festival, just because there was just a bunch of girls that wanted to carry on being partying in the park lot and not being bothered by guys, and nothing feminist or anything. It just happened like all our male friends went to bed. And we wanted to carry on partying, but then as soon as there's a group of girls partying and having fun, like all these men started to come and just like trying to hustle us, and we were like, oh no! So we kept on moving the car places, and then we came back to London and thought that it was a great idea to just put on a party once a month and see each other, because London is so busy that you kind of have to plan every time you want to meet someone. So that was a good excuse to meet once a month.
Well, let's hear the first of the tracks you've brought in now. This is Alerta.
¿Qué son las cosas que decimos? ¿Qué son las cosas digo yo? ¿Qué son las cosas que hicimos? ¿Qué está pasando digo yo? ¿Qué son las cosas que decimos? ¿Qué son las cosas digo yo? ¿Qué son las cosas que hicimos? ¿Qué está pasando digo yo? Salida directa, la solución correcta, la salida directa. Pra, 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 ¿dónde iría a parar? Pra, 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 ¿dónde iría a parar? 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 ¿Qué son las cosas que decimos? ¿Qué son las cosas digo yo? ¿Qué son las cosas que hicimos? ¿Qué está pasando, digo yo? ¿Qué son las cosas que decimos? ¿Qué son las cosas, digo yo?
That was Alerta. Can you tell us a bit about that track?
Alerta is a collaboration with a German artist called Felix Huxman, and his Dutch rhythm combo. That's his project. It's a one person project, but it's called Dutch Rhythm Combo. And he brings artists to collaborate with him, and this was our collaboration. This track was selected to be in the Colette's compilation. Mm. By Jefferson Hack, and then it has a edit by Evan Smaga, and it's been quite popular, especially in France. Got a lot of plays.
Well, should we move along to the second of your selections today? This is a remix that you did. Do you want to introduce it for us?
Yeah, this is a remix I did with my friend Christian Castaño, who is based in Colombia, and we did this remix for Tom Tom Club, celebrating the anniversary of their famous song Genius of Love.
Someone
Tom Tom Club's Genius of Love as remixed by our studio guest Isa GT, better otherwise known as Isabella Gonzalez Toro. Tom Tom Club, the band formed by Chris France and Tina Weymouth from Talking Heads, and obviously very well known and very well established. When you're taking on a sort of well-known track by a well-known artist to remix, how do you go about that? Where do you start?
I do the same if it's a well-known artist and or an unknown artist. When I receive the stems or parts for a song, there is something that clicks inside of me, and there's ideas that come, and well, there's pressure. If you ask, in this case, it is a very, very well-known song, but I just started working in the studio with my friend Christian, and just came up with lyrics, and there's a muse that comes and just started playing with all the elements, and as a friend of mine said this not long ago, being in the studio is being in like what it could be for a scientist, a lab. Mm. So you just try things out and you just have all your elements and start playing around. And then just things come to you. I think that's what happens to me.
But do you see what you're doing there as, I guess, trying to improve on the original track or just take it in a different direction?
I've done maybe 8 remixes in my whole career and so far. And I wanna. They're all very different, and as I am, you know, as an artist, I play very different music. If you listen to my mixes, I put together all sorts of tracks that I like, and I you know, it's my taste. I try to be a filter that I, you know, like my perception. What people is gonna hear is my perception of things. So if sometimes in mixes I put like jazz with techno and house and folklore. That's who I am. So I try to make it mine. In this case, I wrote lyrics and just sample bits of the vocals. There's some other people that do edits that sound much more like the actual original song. But yeah, in this case, I just came up with a twist instead of saying "Where is my boyfriend," which is kind of the Genius of Love song, what it is about, that is like looking for this person or boyfriend that is not there. I was just saying I don't need a boyfriend. I don't need, you know, I don't need that. I'm having fun, basically. So it's I'm having a natural fun. So that's the name of the remix.
Do you ever find yourself getting into the place just briefly of worrying about what the original artists are going to think of your remix, or do you have to just put that out of your head?
Well, luckily with this one, Tom Tom Club really, really liked it, so it was chosen. But as you know, as a creative, when you do these kind of things, sometimes you pitch for projects. So you do your best and hope they like it. If they like it, they release it. If they don't, not. But I try to be true to myself. That's one of the advantages of not being super commercial, or you know, or having a massive label behind me or something like that. I have some liberties within my work. So I try to be true to what I like, and if they like it, it's good.
Okay, your final selection today is one from your own label, I believe. So do you want to introduce this one for us?
Yeah, this is the single of my latest EP. It's called Legenda, which means legend in English. And this is me on vocals, and it just tells a story. In my latest EP, I went into more introspective ways, and I tried to make more of a, this sounds more folklore. My vocals are more like folklore, Colombian folklore, and they tell a story of two, a brother and a sister, and how the sister finds love in this remote place in the jungle.
Issa GT, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
La profundidad de una villa lejana se esconde la leyenda de un capo y su hermana. Manera muy bella, más que las estrellas, pero su hermanito era muy malito.
And that was Leyenda by this week's musical guest, Issa GT. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll be looking at the world of theatre after this.
Wherever you're going this summer, and whether it's for work or play, let Monocle's editors be your travel companions. We've just refreshed and revised our team's guides to the world's top business cities and resorts, so you can have our 25-25 travel guide series in the palm of your hand with the Monocle app, available from iTunes, or download free guides from monocle.com. From São Paulo to New York, Capri to St. Bart's, we can show you where to long lunch or go for your morning run. Just head to the iTunes App Store and download the Monocle app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Nestled into the urban fabric of London, Hong Kong, New York and Tokyo, Monocle shops are small, cosy outposts of everything we care about. That's incredible design, credible provenance, charming service, and of course, intelligent journalism. Stock up on the latest issue of the magazine, browse our carefully curated selection of books and music, or seek out your favourite back issue to fill that gap in your Monocle archive. So, drop in to one of our shops, and our friendly staff will be on hand to show you around. For addresses and opening hours, visit monocle.com.
Welcome back. It's Saturday. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian Tobias, and Andrew Muller.
As we've noted a few times this afternoon, our weekly magazine review is no longer our weekly magazine review. It has stretched its wings to become its own take flight. Yeah, you see where we're going with that. Anyway, it's become its own programme called The Stack, which made its debut today at 10 a.m. London time, hosted by our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. If you missed it, you can catch it up on iTunes at monocle.com/24 or through our mobile app.
And with magazines out of the mix, we now have more time to review theatre, dance, TV and film. And I'm delighted to say today we're joined in studio by Matt Wolfe, London theatre critic for the International Herald Tribune. And Matt's here to give us some tips on upcoming productions in London and New York worth seeing this autumn. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Gillian.
So is it going to be an exciting season ahead in the two cities?
Well, it's always lovely this time of year because there's a fantastic sense of expectation because the shows haven't actually opened. Once they open, who knows what'll happen.
But then the good ones are, you can't book them because the reviews are so great. So that's why it's great for us to have your advice.
Well, it's become a real crapshoot, particularly in New York, where the pricing for shows now is on a sliding scale. So if a show opens and gets raves, the ticket prices triple or quadruple. So now's the chance to book.
Does that make critics such as yourself completely, or I suggest even more deranged with power than you already were?
Impossible to be more deranged. It just means that we solidify our derangement. Although it also means that on the blogosphere, the people who go to the first previews and just blog about whatever they think have a lot of sway because everyone wants to know, okay, should we book like on day two? So... we'll see.
Is there corruption as well?
I couldn't possibly comment on air. But it's amazing, the ticket prices in New York. I mean, I you know, go between New York and London, and New York, just the ticket prices eclipse London. There's an off-Broadway show in previews, hasn't opened yet, so we don't know what it's going to be like. The American theater debut of Jake Gyllenhaal, the Oscar-nominated film actor, and the ticket price for it off-Broadway is $100.
Goodness.
I mean, that's astonishing for an off-Broadway play.
But is that just the pull of Jake Gyllenhaal?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's a not-for-profit theater company called The Roundabout, and they're obviously very happy that they've snared Jake Gyllenhaal to do this. It's a British play, interestingly enough, called If There Is, I Haven't Found It Yet, which was first seen in London without Jake Gyllenhaal in 2009. It's now arrived in New York with him. It's a four-character play in which he does The Bloggers Are Telling Us, a perfectly credible and creditable London accent. So we'll see. But that sort of leapt out of the starting
gate. Always a tricky business.
Yeah, oh, I know. Sooner him than me. But
so what do you think is going to be interesting about that? Is this the writing and the play and the plot, or is it Jake...
Well, I think what's interesting about it, he gave a very fascinating interview with the New York Times where he basically said, you know, Brokeback Mountain, which got him his Oscar nomination, was a while ago now. And since then, he hasn't really had any major movies that have absolutely clicked. He's had no other, you know, awards kudos. And you would have thought he'd be at the top of his game as a film actor, getting what he wants. And he says, actually, the theater's a lot more interesting. He did do a play in London a long time ago on the West End called This Is Our Youth, when nobody knew who he was. And he got an Evening Standard Theater Award then. And I think that that experience was a really rich one for him. So we'll see if he can repeat it in New York.
Well, I think after that, he said that he wanted, after every three films, he wanted to do one play. And he never stuck to that, really.
No, he did like...
Because Hollywood seduces.
He did 13 films or whatever, and now he's doing another play. Because, yeah, and when you're hot in Hollywood, you don't want to take a break and say, oh, I think I'll go do a play for pennies, even though it's costing the audience $100. So it'll be interesting to see whether this is as satisfying for him in New York as This Is Our Youth was all those years ago in London.
And what else is coming up on Broadway?
Well, that play's off Broadway, but on Broadway there's a play by a relatively unknown American writer called Craig Wright. But the star of the play is very well known, Paul Rudd, and he, of course, is popular for being in, you know, practically every third film comedy going, usually with people like Jason Segel and so on. And this is a play about religion called Grace. I assume the title is a pun, and it hasn't been seen in New York before, obviously, although it has been seen in smaller theaters around the country. I think for a Broadway play these days to tackle religion in America is actually kind of brave, because religion's a vexed topic.
Well, obviously, one of the big hits of the last couple of years has been the Book of Mormon on Broadway.
You better believe it. That's right. And, you know, that is pretty out there in its language and treatment, as you would expect from the South Park team. And you might have thought America drifting perhaps to the right wouldn't embrace it. And yet it's a huge, huge hit. So Grace doesn't have that tone or temperament. It's a much more, I gather, much more sober, somber play. But we'll see how Paul Rudd fares with that. He has done a lot of theater, including a couple of plays like Jake Gyllenhaal. He's worked in London. Paul Rudd's been in London on stage twice. And he does go back to the New York theater pretty regularly, and he lives in New York and so on. So this is a return home for him.
But the topic is religion, but I think given that the writer, the past credits include 6 Feet Under, I think there's probably going to be some irreverence here as he covers religion.
I think so. I think it's going to be pretty mordant and probably a little bit weird and perhaps outside the comfort zone for Broadway audiences, which is a good thing.
But when you talk about the comfort zone of Broadway audiences, but isn't that presumably, I know a lot of tourists go to shows on Broadway, but it's still New York. You can probably still get away with stuff on a Broadway stage that might not play in more conservative parts of America.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are plays that only play sort of New York, San Francisco, Chicago, and that's kind of it. I mean, once they hit Atlanta, they're dead. So
possibly literally.
Yes. And it's very interesting in New York because all the serious plays tend to run somewhere between September and May. And then the assumption is that all the New Yorkers in the summer leave, often to come to London. And so Broadway is left to the tourists, and that's a whole different climate. That's why these things are all starting September, October.
Well, let's cross the Atlantic, turn to the spotlight on London. What are you excited about for the fall here?
Well, I'm a huge, huge fan of Sheridan Smith. I just think she's the best. I mean, this is an actress from the north of England who never went to drama school, who, if you ever have the great pleasure to talk to her, as I have, she's ceaselessly self-deprecating. She doesn't think she can do it. And yet she's won the Olivier Award, London's equivalent of the Tony, 2 years in a row. First for her performance in Legally Blonde, the musical playing Elle Woods, and then for a Radigan play called Flare Path. In both, though, she played very likable, sympathetic, endearing women. She's about to play Ibsen's Hedda Gabler, which is a little different from Elle Woods. And if anyone can make the transition from, you know, fluffy and pink to the pistol-wielding general's daughter, I would bank on Sheridan. This is a huge change of direction for her. It's opening at the Old Vic. It's called The Female Hamlet. And, you know, it's really her first step into the canon, the classical canon.
How big a risk is that for an actor, though? Because you must have seen many examples of sort of natural comic actors trying to do the dramatic ones and going not terribly well, and indeed dramatic actors trying to do funny. Some actors do have a limited range.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about Sheridan that we're only just discovering is that her range seems much more elastic than we were led to believe. And then she, in fact, I think wants you to believe. She's very sort of reined in about what she thinks. She doesn't go out there and say, you know, I am going to be the next Judi Dench. And she just sort of goes role by role. And that's very exciting. What's interesting about this is she was originally supposed to do in London the stage musical version of Bridget Jones's Diary. And that was all set. She did the workshop of it twice, three times possibly, and then bowed out of it. Bowed out of another big West End musical in favor of Hedda Gabler. So we'll see.
I suppose as well, if you do have the range, though, once you have established yourself for doing one thing, you have that to subvert and play off.
I think so. And in a way, although I'd love to have seen her on stage as Bridget Jones, she's already done a year plus in a West End musical. This is a whole different game for her. And also, it's a 12 or 16 week run as opposed to a whole year. So it's a different chunk of her time. She's also announced, by the way, in 2013 that she's going to do A Midsummer Night's Dream on the West End playing Titania. So she is embracing the classics in a big way.
But her stepping in the shoes of Hedda Gabler, she follows in some great actresses who've played the role before.
Well, there's been Maggie Smith and, of course, the wonderful Eve Best, who played Hedda Gabler a couple of years ago and
Diana
won the
Rigg.
Olivier Award. Diana Rigg. Eve Best's co-star was a then unknown young actor called Benedict Cumberbatch. So it'll be interesting to see not just Sheridan, but the ensemble around her. It isn't just a one-person show. And, you know, can she sort of put that amiability, which is her stock in trade, on hold and reveal something icier and maybe a little more malignant? I think that'll be the fascination.
And the other London production, you think?
Well, I'm really, really interested by the new Jez Butterworth play. Now, Jez Butterworth is the English writer, extraordinary English writer behind Mark Rylance's play Jerusalem, which was a huge hit here, went to New York. It did surprisingly well there. It came back here where it was an even bigger hit. It's had three different London runs. This is being done in a tiny studio theater upstairs at the Royal Court. It's called The River. It stars Dominic West and Miranda Raison. And we know nothing about it. It's a three-character play. They are expecting ticket demand for it to be so high that they're doing something I've never heard of before, which is that you will not be able to book tickets until the day of each show.
That's
so there's no advanced ticketing available.
This is part of a sort of extremely peculiar career trajectory being negotiated by Dominic West, isn't it? Because you might have thought he would go from The Wire to, you know, being the sort of the great big movie star, and yet he's gone off to play, you know, a serial killer in a very critically acclaimed but very grim TV drama. Mm-hmm. And now, as you say, doing this.
And the odd thing about this, everyone assumed, because, I mean, obviously it's going to be a bit of a sensation, whatever it's like, that it would transfer immediately, but it can't because he is going up to Sheffield in the north of England in December to play Higgins in My Fair Lady. So we will see if he can sing, if he can do his best Rex Harrison impersonation.
Actually, in that role, you really
don't have to sing. You just have to be commanding.
And there's another opportunity there to do a London accent, though, of course, he does have an advantage. Matt Wolfe, London theatre critic for the International Herald Tribune, thank you so much for joining us. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. That's the end of the first instalment of our New Look review. Gillian.
And I think it works really well having it focused on review. So looking forward to next week. Hopefully you're going to be in the hot seat with me.
Hopefully, yes. I haven't thought that far ahead.
But booking
yes,
our seats.
May well be.
Booking our seats. Well, that brings us to the end of the Saturday Review. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. Our show today was produced by Katie Bilbao and Paul Noble, researched by Fernanda Augusto Pacheca, and our studio manager was Jack Phillips.
We're handing back over to Georgina with the weekend edition next, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories on The Curator. And don't forget to tune in to the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air on Sunday at midday London time.
You've been listening to The Review with me, Gillian Tobias, and Andrew Muller. Have a great weekend.